I can always try, right? You're mentioning Gaston Jolin, a brother who works up in Northern Ontario. And I was hearing a story when he was a young fellow, he and his brothers decided to surprise their father on his birthday. And they installed a little gunpowder in his wedding cake, or his birthday cake. And so he lit the cake, and they had put a little too much gunpowder in. They never did find the cake. They blew the windows right out of the house. So it was quite a surprise. No one got hurt, fortunately, but they were surprised as well as he. Now, I'd like to read with you, please, in 2 Chronicles chapter 14. And the Lord's laid on my heart some studies in the stories of the good kings of Judah. And I'm going to cover some of them as the Lord enables. And then a little later in the month, you're going to have the real good stuff. Brother Dave, I think, is going to be taking up two of these kings. But I'd like to look with you this evening at the story of good King Asa. 2 Chronicles 14 and verse 1, So Abijah slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David, and Asa his son reigned in his stead. In his days the land was quiet 10 years, and Asa did that which was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God. For he took away the altars of the strange gods and the high places, and brake down the images, and cut down the groves, and commanded Judah to seek the Lord God of their fathers, and to do the law and the commandment. And he took away out of all the cities of Judah the high places and the images, and the kingdom was quiet before him. And he built fenced cities in Judah, for the land had rest, and he had no war in those years, because the Lord had given him rest. Therefore he said unto Judah, Let us build these cities, and make about them walls, and towers, gates, and bars, while the land is yet before us, because we have sought the Lord our God. We have sought him, and he hath given us rest on every side. So they built and prospered. Verse 9, There came out against them Zerah the Ethiopian with a host of a thousand and 300 chariots, and came unto Marisha. Then Asa went out against him, and they set the battle in array in the valley of Zephatha at Marisha. And Asa cried unto the Lord his God, and said, Lord, it is nothing with thee to help, whether with many or with them that have no power. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rest on thee, and in thy name we go against this multitude. O Lord, thou art our God. Let not man prevail against us. Oh, it doesn't say that, does it? Let not man prevail against thee. So the Lord smote the Ethiopians before Asa, and before Judah, and the Ethiopians fled. And Asa and the people that were with him pursued them unto Gerar. And the Ethiopians were overthrown, and they could not recover themselves, for they were destroyed before the Lord and before his host, and they carried away very much spoil. And they smote all the cities round about Gerar, for the fear of the Lord came upon them. And they spoiled all the cities, for there was exceeding much spoil in them. They smote also the tents of the cattle, carried away sheep and camels in abundance, and returned to Jerusalem. And so ends chapter 1 in the life of good King Asa. Asa had a wicked father, the man whose name is Abijah. And he had a wicked and foolish grandfather, whose name was Rehoboam. This man is the great grandson of good King Solomon. But Asa had had a very poor upbringing. He had bad examples set before him. But Asa, as a young man, determined to be different. I think very often we hear this today that, we don't have any good examples. If we just had better elders, why, then we'd be better people. I'd like to suggest to you that if you don't have good examples, you can always be one. And that's exactly the story of the good kings of Judah. That over the reigns of these kings, about 20 or 21 kings and one very wicked queen in Judah, there were 8 men who have not the good housekeeping seal of approval, but the approval of Jehovah himself. He measures them all and he says, there were some who walked in the ways of their fathers. They did as their fathers did. And there were others who sought after the Lord. Now it's always easy to float with the stream. Any dead fish can float with the stream, float with the current. And the spirit of the age will drag us down, will take us away from God. We're going to have to take a stand for God, and it's going to be an expensive proposition if we're going to stand for God in an evil day. We don't need many verses. The land having rest until the enemy comes up against them. And you'll always find that if you're going to live for God, the enemy is going to be there. We have an advocate, but we also have an adversary. And you can be sure that if you take your stand with God, you will draw the enemies of God against you. You can count on that as soon as you stand for God. I'd like you to notice a few phrases in chapter 14 that were an encouragement to me. We have the eyes of the Lord in verse 2, and seeking the Lord in verse 4, and the Lord giving them rest in verse 6, and the help of the Lord in verse 11, and the fear of the Lord in verse 14. Asa, his name means physician, and I'm not sure why he was given that name. Some people like to name their children after the doctor, I suppose, in gratitude. There may have been a hard birth, I don't know. In any case, they called him physician. Maybe he was interested in science and had a little chemistry kit when he was a child. I don't know why he got that name, but that's what they called him, physician. Well, we have a good prescription here in this chapter in the life of King Asa, a good prescription for any of us for spiritual sickness. When we get spiritually sick, this is a time of year when people start to feel a little uneasiness in their throat, a little tightness. They feel the swollen glands. One morning you wake up and it hurts when you swallow your orange juice. But you know, there's a more serious problem than that, isn't there? This is a day in which we are living when people are becoming spiritually sick, languid, careless, losing their spiritual appetite, don't feel like eating the Word of God anymore. A spiritual temperature, that they get a bit flushed about things. And as we look at this wonderful prescription for restoration and for renewed fellowship with God, I hope we'll take it, not from Asa, not from J.B. Nicholson, but as from the great physician himself. For these ingredients in the prescription are the very same ingredients we find in the New Testament. The first one we find in verse 3. We read that Asa, verse 2, did that which was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God. Now that's the true measure, isn't it? It's not what does my brother think of me, or my family, or my neighbors, but what does the Lord think of me? What's his assessment? You can tell a lot from the eyes, can't you? In fact, that's one of the things that a doctor usually does, is he looks into your eyes, because it's the only place that you can see a nerve. That's where the optic nerve is visible. And they can tell a great deal. It's where the blood vessels can be seen. And they look into your eye, and they learn a great deal. But I tell you, dear Christians, that the purposes of God are to guide us with his eye, that we look into his face and we see the displeasure in his eye, before he should ever speak a word to our conscience, we should be conscious that we have disappointed him. And if that's true, if we are in such close fellowship with him through his word and in prayer that we sense his disapproval, then we will be kept safe from this spiritual languor and sickness that is all around us today. And of course, the dangerous thing about this sickness is that it's catching, isn't it? It's very contagious. And we can get it from one another. This worldliness is catching. I was down in the Bahamas not too long ago, and I had a young fellow with me, and he wanted to do a little fishing. And there were some Americans there with their big fancy boats, and we could have gone out with them. They had their big lures and their fancy reels and rods, and but I said no, that's they aren't the people to go out with down here. We went out with old Robbie Weatherford. He's an old fellow, and he's got looks like a little bathtub with a motor on it, and one conch shell. You know what a conch shell looks like, and a little hammer that he uses to break the conch, and a knife to cut up the mussel. And two lines, just lines and rusty hooks, that's it. And he takes us out into the blue, and he says, now over here there's some trucks they dumped in from Marsh Harbor. Now you'll be able to see them just in a minute here. Line up, you see that tree over there on that island? And see that telephone pole over there on that island? Right about here. There. Well, we couldn't see a thing, but he could. And that was all that was important. So I said, okay, now we'll go back up against the current a little bit and throw in the anchor there. Okay, now let's give it a try. And in about 2 minutes, he had that mussel out of that conch shell, and he cut off a piece and put it on the hook and threw it out, and then he started to chum with pieces. He started banging on this conch shell. It was to call the fish to dinner or something. I don't know what they were supposed to do. But anyway, we were out for 2 hours. 2 hours from the time we left the dock until we were back at the dock, and we pulled in over 40 fish. Well, he knew where to fish. But you know something else? The best part about the trip was not catching 40 fish, because I'm not much of a fisherman. It was just sitting and talking to Brother Robbie under that beautiful blue sky. He's never made much money in his life. Most of the other islanders have done pretty well for themselves. He's raised his family for God, though, and all his children are busy serving the Lord. His son has gone over and worked with the Haitians and built by hand an assembly building there and seen people saved and baptized. He learned the Creole language the hard way, just by bits and pieces. His daughter goes down into the other islands and has children's meetings, and it's an interesting thing at the assembly there. They sing a little song. It was on a Monday, somebody saved me. You know that little song? They sing, it was on a Monday, somebody saved me. And everybody stands up who was saved on a Monday, see? And then on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you go right through the week. And then, I forget what the last one is. It's for all the people who don't know what day it was they got saved, and they all get up on that one. But most of the young people get up on Wednesday. And Wednesday's the day that this girl has a little children's meeting on the island. And you see all these kids get up. It's a wonderful thing to see. And Robbie's raised his family for God. Sad to say, many of the other young people on the island are not interested at all in spiritual things. And Robbie made this assessment of the situation. He said, you know, we used to be just a little island off here. Nobody knew we were here. We had one of the finest harbors in the Caribbean, and beautiful fishing, and a lovely spot. And pretty soon the Americans found us with all their money. And they came over with their big boats, and they built their big houses, and they had their VCRs and their satellite dishes. And he said they were missionaries. They brought the gospel of materialism, of heaven here and now. Now, he said, we knew the Lord, and we have the Bible gospel. But he said they were better missionaries than we were. He said they converted us. we didn't convert them. And you see, that's the great tragedy today, isn't it? That instead of the church converting the world is converting the church. What is the solution? It's to begin to live our lives again under the eye of God. To live to please Him and not ourselves. Even Christ pleased not Himself. Just the day before yesterday, I went into the bank. We had sent some money over to a group in West Germany trying to get the money, some supplies, into the Christians in Romania. And because of the political situation, they couldn't get the money in, so they sent us back our money order. Well, we tried to get it in another way, so I went down to the bank and I said, I'd like to change this money order. I'd like to cash it in and transfer it to another money order to another man that we know over in Wales who goes in, Mr. Roger Brind. And so she said, did you initially purchase this money order? And I said, yes, I did. So she turned the money order over, and before she got me to endorse it, she wrote on the top, redeemed by Maker. You know, that thrilled my heart. It was the last thing I expected to see standing in a bank, redeemed by Maker. And I thought, well, sure enough, I said to the lady, you know, that's true. I've been redeemed by my Maker. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, just like this money order. I said, they just couldn't use it the way it was. It was useless to them. And I said, I was a poor sinner, and I couldn't help myself, and I was useless to God. But He arranged a way by which, through the death of His Son, He could pay the price for my sin. And I've been redeemed by my Maker. Well, I'm sure she didn't expect that, but I didn't expect it either. She was the one that wrote it down. She gave me my sermon, didn't she? There it was, redeemed by Maker. Oh, Christian, if we could just remember that we're not here to please ourselves. We are living our lives under the eye of God. And even Christ pleased not Himself. And that's what we're here for. We are not our own. We are redeemed with a price, the precious blood of Christ. Why did He please the Lord? What was it that was good and right in the eyes of the Lord His God? Well, first of all, in verse 3, He took away the altars of the strange gods and the high places and break down the images and cut down the groves. The altars speak of the costliness of idolatry. You know, it's an expensive business to serve idols. Now, some people think it's expensive to be a Christian, and it is. But it's just as expensive to live for idols, you know. I see people who are pouring their lives away, who are pouring their money out and their energies, to gather to themselves dust, a few little toys, a few status symbols, and they will give up their families, their health, their weekends. They will give up everything they have for their idols. Don't think you get away cheaply by living for idols. Idols will cost you everything. Moloch will take your children from you. It was the idol that stole away the virginity of the young women, that took the money, that took the freedom, that took the joy, that took everything away from the people who worshiped them. Instead of giving them, all the idols could ever do was take. And that's how it is with every idol. An idol always takes. And never gives us anything. It promises a great deal. Idols promise us satisfaction, joy, peace. Whatever it is you're looking for, these idols will give it to you, but they can't do that. Why, God mocks the idols through His prophets, and He says, imagine a man coming and getting a log of wood. And he takes out his axe, and he cuts that log in half. And he takes half of the log, and with it he starts a fire to keep himself warm, while he carves the other half of the log into a god. And what fate made that log just a bit of kindling, and this log his god? And he carves his own god out, and if the god falls over, he has to prop him up. And he has to bring him food. And the idol never gives him a thing. That's the picture that God gives us of the world and all its idols. Now every man is a worshiper. And you will either worship the true God, or you will make idols for yourself to worship. And Paul, writing to the church at Thessalonica, said, you turn to God from idols. To serve the living and true God. You were serving dumb idols, and you will serve your idols just as surely as you can serve the living God. There is a price to be paid, but he took away the altars and the high places and break down the images and cut down the groves. You know, many of these good kings, we read of them, that they removed the idols, but they left the high places. It was only partial. I don't know what they did exactly. Maybe they put them off in a warehouse somewhere. But you see, as long as the high places were there, the temptation was there. The Lord had established his worship. He had placed his name in Jerusalem at the temple, and that's where he wanted them to worship. And when God establishes our way, when he sets before us the path that we are to take, if we diverge from that, if we go our own way and redesign things to please ourselves, as wicked King Jeroboam did, the people pleaser, you can be sure that tragedy will follow. Now, some people have the strange notion that if you follow the New Testament pattern in the assembly, you won't have any problem. Well, that would be true, assuming there weren't any people there. Well, the problem is we have people, and people have problems. So if you're following the New Testament pattern, all you have to do is read the New Testament to discover you're going to have problems. But you will have biblical answers to your problems. But you see, if you get away from the New Testament pattern and say, well, we'll worship God in our own way, we'll go to the groves to worship, instead of worshiping the Lord's designated way, you know what happens? Well, you have problems too. But this time, when you have problems, you don't have biblical solutions to the problem. So you have to make up your own solution. And when you do that, latent in that solution is another problem. So you say, well, what we'll do is we'll have one teaching elder, and he'll do all the teaching here. Well, of course, he has to be trained, and so we'll need some sort of a school to train him. And of course, we'll need a board to govern the school to make sure that they're doctrinally sound, and a statement of faith, of course, and they'll have to have a budget, and so we'll have to have fund drives, and so it goes. And men establish for themselves these other ways, and they may be high places, they may be exalted notions, they may be good ideas, and they may make sense, but they're not God's way. They actually, in the days of some of these good kings, actually tried to worship the Lord in the high places. They were trying to worship the true God, but they were trying to do it in their own way. God has not left us to our own devices. He has told us how we are to gather, and how we are to worship, and how we are to serve him. But he broke them down and cut down the groves. No compromise. He ground them to powder. He got rid of them. And dear Christian, there are idols in our lives, and they crop up so easily, don't they? Those little niches, those little areas of our life, it may be self that we have there. It may be success. It may be money, or the love of money. It may be our families. Whatever it is that gets between our soul and God, that captivates our time and our energies and our thought life and our resources, little children, keep yourselves from idols. Now that was very negative, wasn't it? That was a negative thing to do. He went and he broke something down. But you see, that's always the start of it. Sin always has to be dealt with. When people came to God, the first thing they came to was the trespass offering. And that's a very negative thing. And God didn't take any pleasure in it. But if we're going to go on with God, the first thing is negative. We're going to have to deal with some of those things in our lives that are not pleasing to Him. But that wasn't the end of it. There was breaking down, but then there was building. Verse 6, he built fence cities in Judah. And in verse 7, we read that he built cities, walls, towers, gates, bars. Not only was there the removal of idols, but there was the restoring of the defenses. Now, when we're careless about the things of God, there are breaches made in the wall. There are broken places in the wall. There are areas where we give the enemy an advantage to get in. If I've been doing something that's wrong, something that's careless, and it's unconfessed, it isn't dealt with, that is a weak spot in my defense. That's where the enemy can get in. For example, I've been doing something that isn't right, and I have a bad conscience about it. And at a moment's notice, I have to pray to God. I'm in a crisis, and I go to pray to Him, but this thing comes up, like a phantom. And it says to my conscience, Nicholson, you don't deserve to be heard. I'm regarding iniquity in my heart. I go to witness to someone. And just as I open my mouth, I bite my tongue because I know that it's not a reality in my own life. The defenses get broken down. And the enemy can come in and do what he will. And he thrashes me. He minimizes the sins before I commit them. And then he maximizes them after I commit them. And he says, look at you, Nicholson, you call yourself a Christian? What are you doing witnessing? You're a hypocrite. And he shuts my mouth, and my conscience is inflamed until I deal with it, until I confess it, until it's taken out of the way. I can't do anything. But once that's done, then I have to build up the defenses again. And you'll notice this, cities. There is a need for fellowship. That's what cities speak of, the congregation of people. That harmony, that fellowship, that enjoyment of the people of God together for security, for the enjoyment of one another, for mutual benefit. That's what the city was for. And we can't have that if we're out of touch with God. But once that has been restored, then we are not only restored to God, we're restored to one another. If you're out of fellowship with God, you can come to the building here and you can sit in the pew, but you're not in fellowship with the people of God. You can have your name on the list, you know, but if you're not in fellowship with God, there will be a strain between you and your brothers and sisters. But once you're restored to fellowship with Him, then you're restored to fellowship with the people of God too. And there is a desperate need among us today for true heart fellowship. Not just, hi, how are you doing, and down the stairs before you get the answer. But the true sharing what we have in common, the life that we share, the work that we share, the fellowship of the gospel, working together in the gospel, laboring together, that's what fellowship is. It's not going bowling. It is sharing what we have in common, the things of God, the life of faith. And we need the cities to be built up again. And the walls to be built up. Not only a need for fellowship, but a need for separation. You know, in Nehemiah's day, the enemy was glad to have the Jews around until they started to rebuild the wall. And when they started to rebuild the wall, all of a sudden everybody got upset. And you know, the world is glad to have the Christians around as long as you don't take a stand. as long as you don't build up the wall of separation. And say, I'm sorry, but there are some things in my life that have to be out, and there are some things that have to be in. And that's where the wall is. And the wall was built on the same foundation that had been established hundreds of years before. And when we build up that wall, it's going to be an expensive thing, because some things are going to be walled in and some things are going to be walled out. And it's going to be hard work. And we're going to have to labor as they did in Nehemiah's day, with a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. And then towers, a need for watchfulness. The towers had to be built again. They had broken down. No one was watching for the enemy. And the enemy was sure to come. And it wasn't long before those towers came in handy, because the Ethiopians swept in, 1,000 men and 300 chariots. A need for watchfulness. Oh, Christians, watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. Watch out. Watch your enemy. Don't give him any advantage. And then gates. That speaks of communion, doesn't it? The open door. Now, the gates were shut sometimes, and they were open sometimes. Some people think of the Christian life as just all walls, no gates. Well, that's isolation. That's not separation. The gates were there, too. And there was communion. There was the opening up and receiving others in. But it demanded carefulness. At the gates, they established porters. Do you know, in the assembly, the elders are to stand and watch and be careful who comes in and who goes out. And in the home, do you know who the porter is? Well, it's the mother. She is called the keeper of the home. And the word for keeper is the word porter. Someone who stood at the drawbridge at the keep and controlled who came in and who went out, what the influences were, what kind of magazines come in, what the children watch on the television and what they listen to on the radio and who their friends are. The atmosphere in the home, the sister's going to have to give an account for that. That's her responsibility. And we need porters at the gates today, because the gates are wide open and anyone can come in and anyone can go out. And I'm afraid if we don't have holiness in the home, we can't expect holiness in the assembly. And then the bars, a need for security. Oh, what security there is for the child of God when we have our lives established on the Word of God.